It's as if you and I do this all day, every day.
It is indeed just like that.
I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Current Geek. This is our autopilot episode, and it's going to be great. Autopilot edition. Woo! A chance for us to watch the pilot episode of a TV show and geek out about it. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. And this week, we're talking about, I think, the greatest sitcom in the history of comedy television, Fawlty Towers. Yeah.
Oh, I felt like doing that.
No, that was a good time for it. Perfect timing. Nice job.
Yeah, I think this is a great example of what Scott and I have always felt the show is.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've had a hard time explaining it to people, but I think I've finally gotten into a groove. Like, this show is Scott and I geek out about things.
Yep.
Whether we're geeking out about things we saw on the web, or we're geeking out about movies or TV shows or video games or comics or whatever. And autopilot episodes of Current Geek are geeking out about a TV show. And man, is there no better television show to geek out about, except maybe Monty Python, than Fawlty Towers?
I agree. And I would even say maybe even more so for Fawlty Towers, only in this one way. Monty Python is classic as it is, and I could sit down and watch Flying Circus or any of the movies any given time of my day. I had that stuff memorized like you did. Our generation just ate that stuff up. That being said, I think that Fawlty Towers has a perhaps broader potential appeal. It can make a lot of people laugh that don't necessarily like the weird humor that is often associated with Monty Python. It's often silly to the point of extravagantly silly. And again, nothing wrong with any of that, but I'm not sure it has as broad an appeal as something like Fawlty Towers does, which is a very relatable kind of show. An uppity hotel owner who's kind of a jackass, treats everybody like crap, but ends up kind of, you know, eating his own crow every time. And another great cast of characters around him to sort of make that all pan out. And John Cleese at the center of it being a genius. It's an incredible show. And I can watch it over and over and over again. And in fact, this is probably only the fourth time I've seen the pilot episode in the last month, 2 months, because it's on all the time. We just love Fawlty Towers in this house.
You're like, oh, it's only the fourth time I've seen it in the last 2 months.
Well, I don't know. Like, it's kind of on perpetual replay. Like, it's the thing. If we just watch some serious drama at night, it's one of the things that we'll go to say, all right, well, we're going to turn this on to kind of
your palate cleanser.
The palate cleanser, exactly. It's just a funny freaking show. I find it very rewatchable is the other thing. In the same way that I like Futurama, it's a very different show, but I can watch it over and over again. I don't get sick of specific episodes. A lot of TV, I want to see the episode and move on and never see that episode again. It doesn't make the series bad. It just means I consume the thing you made and I'm done with it. This is one of those things where I can just go back and go back and go back. So how do you feel about it?
It was ranked first on a list of the 100 greatest British television programs that was drawn up by the British Film Institute in 2000. So you are not alone in your praise of Fawlty Towers. Mm. Number one British television program, according to the British Film Institute, is a pretty high honor.
Sure.
If you look at other rankings of greatest television series, greatest British television series, it's always near the top.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't discover it in 1975. It debuted with the pilot episode, A Touch of Class, on September 19th, 1975. I probably got to it in the 80s, early 80s, on reruns on PBS, like most of us here in the US did for British television.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to it after getting to know Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Mm.
I had seen that on PBS a bunch. I had watched the movies, obviously, by renting them at That's Rentertainment, the local video rental chain, or not even chain, the video rental store in Greenville.
Yeah.
And so I was excited when I discovered Fawlty Towers. I'm like, oh, John Cleese, he did something else. I was really disappointed the first time I watched it.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I love it. Don't get me wrong. I should put that right out on Front Street. Like, I believe Fawlty Towers is one of the greatest television shows. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
But when I watched it the first time, I was like, ooh, this is too much John Cleese in concentrated form. Where are my silly walks? You know, where are my funny Eric Idle sketches? Because I came to it wanting more Monty Python.
Sure.
And that's not what they were giving you.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is, as you said, it's in some ways a much more mainstream sitcom. Mm-hmm. And it's John Cleese exploring an idea. It's not a sketch.
No.
It's not a sketch comedy show. But I, you know, that was an important learning process for me, I think, back, you know, I don't know, 13 years old, 14 years old, because I had to realize, like, oh, things can be good even if they're not what I expected them to be.
Sure.
I think, and I, you know, I see that playing out all the time in popular culture. Like, wait a minute, this sequel to my favorite franchise is not what I expected to be. It sucks. Well, hold on. I learned from Fawlty Towers. Maybe it doesn't suck. Maybe it's just different. And Fawlty Towers is definitely that. Like, once I recalibrated and said, okay, I can't think about this as John Cleese from Monty Python's Flying Circus. I've got to think about this as just another British comedy to go along with Are You Being Served and sure. Ab Fab and all of those kinds of shows. And then I learned to love it and got very, very sad, Scott, when I found out that it only ever had 12 episodes.
Yeah.
Two seasons of six episodes.
Very British run, you know, like six episodes per series, as they would call them. Two series total. A complete run of 12 episodes is not enough. Fawlty
and
Towers.
Two series 4 years apart. The first series came out in 1975. The second didn't come out till 1979 because they had to talk Connie Booth into doing the second series.
Yeah, they didn't want to do it. And some of their best work is in season two, by the way. So I'm really glad that they did it. However, I'm in the same boat as you. I didn't see this show until like 84, 85. Never even heard of it. Shows up on PBS one night. I laughed my head off and I went, oh my gosh, he was already my favorite Python. He was my guy. And he's like a lot of people's favorite Python. It's kind of hard to get around it. Like, John Cleese is way too visible of a Python to ignore him within that group. I respect them all. But if anything, my learning experience was I had a favorite Python through all my young years. It was him. It was John Cleese. And everybody else in my mind then was like five or six steps behind him in terms of, you know, what potential they had. That's since changed. My learning process has been in more recent years, or probably in my, I don't know, late 20s and moving forward, I have gotten around to fully appreciating the genius of all of those guys. And now I don't really kind of have a favorite. I have a greater appreciation of the rest of the Pythons. And I could watch Monty Python, like I said, any minute now. If you just told me, hey, we're going to stop this podcast and watch Monty Python, I'd say, okay, let's do it. But this really hit me right where I lived, which was, I was in full-blown John Cleese mode, and I seemed to know then, and I think I still know it now, or at least I had a sense of this then, and I think this is how I still feel. This show doesn't even work at all without him. Like, at all. It's farcical and silly and over the top, and very Three's Company in that there's always a confusion, and everyone's hearing something wrong, and there's a big mess to deal with, And when someone finally figures it out, it all goes to crap in the end. Every episode's like this. They're all kind of that structure. And without John Cleese at the helm playing Basil Fawlty in the way he does, I think this is a bad show. Like, I actually don't think it works. It's his portrayal. It's his dedication to the physicality of who Basil Fawlty is that I think carries it. And it carries it so well that it turns what would otherwise be kind of a mundane premise into a all-time classic. Like,
I've got three thoughts on that.
All right.
First thought is that is in fact what turned me off when I first saw Fawlty Towers, because I think at the time maybe Graham Chapman was my favorite.
You are kind of a Graham Chapman guy. That's true. I can totally see that.
Cleese was a little bit too abrasive. Mm-hmm. And man, Basil Fawlty is like everything abrasive about John Cleese is put on display. So it took me a while to get over like, oh, he's such a horrible character. And it's like, yeah, that's the point. Right. And so you're absolutely right. No one else but John Cleese could do that. In fact, point number two, BBC executive Jimmy Gilbert said of the first script that Cleese pitched for Fawlty Towers, this is full of cliched situations, stereotypical characters, and I cannot see it being anything other than a disaster. You're going to have to get them out of the hotel, John. You can't do the whole thing in the hotel. Which, of course, they do leave the hotel here and there, but sure. The whole point is to have them all cooped up in the hotel so that they boil over.
Right.
Point number three is we have some scientific control experiments to prove your point that without John Cleese, Fawlty Towers doesn't work.
Right.
May I point you to 1978's Chateau Snavely, starring Harvey Korman and Betty White.
Yeah.
Piloted, never brought to air. Or Amanda's, starring Bea Arthur in 1983. 8 episodes, 13 were shot, it was dropped from air. Hane in 1999, starring John Larroquette. 9 episodes produced, 8 aired. And a German pilot based on the sitcom made in 2001 named Zum Eisenkleef, but further episodes were not made. So you just can't recapture it. They tried 4 times, and granted, they made more episodes than season 1 of Fawlty Towers just because of the U.S. model,
right?
But they never caught on.
No, and it's. I was going to actually watch that Snavely thing or try to find it for this, and I ran out of time. I still kind of want to track that down. We may end up wanting to do that in the future, but I'd be really curious just to see the attempt. And, you know, I know in my heart of hearts, Harvey Korman's a really funny dude. You hire him for a thing, you're getting one of the great comedians of his time.
Betty White ain't no slouch either, is she?
No, that whole crew, everybody in that time, where they knew what they were doing. They had their chops. It's just, there's something here, and it's a once in a lifetime, well, 12 in a lifetime thing. 12 total episodes. It's just a piece of his career that required him to be in it. But I would say this a lot about a lot of things that Cleese has been in. I don't think that A Fish Called Wanda is any good at all without him. It's a great movie, but I look at it through the lens of, well, what if he's not here? What if it's somebody else? It's not even close to the same movie. Like, it's that important that he's there. Now, you can say with smaller roles, like where he plays the nearly headless Nick in the Harry Potter movies, big deal. It's a very small part. It's a bit part. When he played Q in the couple of the James Bond movies, brilliant casting. But at the end of the day, you can still have your James Bond without him. But when he is a important character in the story, I think the story can take a backseat because he owns it in such a way that it's impossible to compete with. And Fawlty Towers is like this perfect example of that. It's really not that funny without him. But with him there, the jokes land. The physicality is very funny. I even appreciate some, especially in this pilot, there are some jokes that don't land on the audience very well. You're not getting a lot of studio laughs out of it. They weren't quite used to it yet. Reminds me of Python, honestly, in the early days. But I love those jokes because I know those are going to hit later. I'll hear him make one and I'll go, oh, no one laughed at that, but they're going to later because that's freaking funny and that's totally Basil Fawlty. Like, it's just this home-cooked comfort food for me, this movie or this show, and I could watch it anytime. In high school, I always tell the story. I may as well tell it now. In high school, I was so into Fawlty Towers reruns. And back then, we're only getting it on PBS like on a once a week or something, right? We couldn't binge it. We didn't have all the discs or tapes or anything. That was the only way I could get it. And so I would record it when I could on VHS. But what I would do is I would put my tape recorder up next to my TV, family TV. We'd play the episode, record the whole thing. Everyone in the room had to shut up. Nobody could laugh or talk because I wanted to have this like pristine recording on my tape recorder. And then I would take that tape, stick it in my yellow sports Walkman, and I would take that thing to school. And in between classes and in classes where they let us have headphones on, earbuds, whatever, I would sit and listen to that episode from the night before. And I had the entire 12 episodes on audio tape, of all things.
Wow.
And yeah. I loved
we
it.
We used repeat to do that. Listening. They actually put episodes out on record, on long playing record.
Oh, really?
For people.
That's yeah, awesome. I wish I'd have known about it. I would have probably had a better transfer. But
yeah,
I was so into it. That's like, there are two things that made me do that. And there were only two things that did. It was episodes of that and Late Night with David Letterman. I would record him the night before and listen to him the next day, even though I'd already seen the episode. I was obsessed with doing this. So why it was only Fawlty Towers, and all, there are a lot of British comedies I appreciate and enjoy. None of them did for me what this did. Just heads and tails for me.
It's so funny because I still, as much as I like Fawlty Towers, don't like it as much as you. I'm very convinced of this at this point because I never recorded it on audio cassette. I did that with other things. Mm-hmm. MASH the movie, for instance, I recorded on audio cassette. Mm-hmm. I used to record David Letterman on VHS and watch it over again. Like so many things in your story are parallel, but Fawlty Towers never caught me because it was just that first impression of too abrasive never quite left, even as I learned to appreciate it. So I had to take it in measured amounts. Mm-hmm. I couldn't overexpose myself to it, which is really interesting. To your point about Cleese,
yeah.
I think, well, first of all, we should not underestimate the contribution of Connie Booth.
Oh, no.
Connie Booth is just as essential to making not only this work as sort of the she doesn't get much in action in the first episode, but Polly, sort of the straight man made, is the great foil for the back and forth between the husband and wife, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And Connie Booth also was genius in creating this and writing it. And I will submit to you as evidence of this proposition that in 2016, Cleese and Booth co-wrote the official theatrical adaptation of Fawlty Towers, which premiered in Melbourne at the Comedy Theater, and it was well-reviewed.
This was a thing?
Cleese isn't in it.
Where is this? Oh, really?
Yeah. He's not in it. It's an entirely different cast, but he is the creative force behind it, as is Connie. You know, and some people say, well, it's not as good as, you know, the television show. You can't capture lightning in a bottle. But I think it shows that it was this team, right? I mean, you're absolutely right about Cleese being an unparalleled talent, and he has the ability to elevate things that he was in.
Yeah.
But I also think there was a little bit of that magic chemistry between him and Connie Booth. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were married,
yeah,
and then they weren't married, and they still did the second season not being married. And as you said, the second season often considered to be the better one.
Yeah. I sometimes wonder when they decided to do that, if just the act of pushing through that natural barrier of we are apart now was a key moment in actually cracking open all the creativity of season two. Season two is brilliant. Season one's great too. There's nothing wrong with any of it, but there is some really special stuff in season two. There's an episode where a patron of the hotel dies during the night, and it's the most wonderful episode of anything ever. Like, I could watch that
is one that
times.
that really kind of convinced me. Like, okay, this is a pretty hilarious
so good.
Show. Like, it's so dark.
It's yeah. so good. And you're right. Connie Booth's amazing in it. For those, here's some fun trivia about her. She they were married. Yes. She's the witch that they're trying to see if she'll float in the Holy Grail. She has the false nose on. So she did a lot of little other stuff with the Pythons in terms of, you know, showing up as bit parts in the movie.
She was the Lumberjacks girl.
Exactly.
The Lumberjack.
That's
yeah.
right. She was a few of the shows. Anyway, she's like from Minnesota. She doesn't have this accent, but she does it beautifully. Sounds as British as any of us could try, and beats us all at it. Yeah. yeah. And really fits the role, I think. But she becomes this really important anchor for the show. And that's the other thing that maybe these other adaptations are missing. I don't know, because I haven't seen them, but I'll bet they're missing just the right kind of Polly. She's just crucial to it. You can have the
and
foil with Manuel. Yes, exactly. You can have the foil with Manuel. You can have the overly picky wife who's always giving him a hard time and making his life hard, and him always sort of rebelling against her. Those are easier roles. I shouldn't say easy, but they're the ones that you can cast and kind of have a much more general scattershot approach to. But there's something about hers. She's very, what's the word?
Normal,
but also you just really feel for her a lot of times. Like, oh yeah. man, this would suck to be in charge of this. And on the other hand, she's kind of the hero of half of the resolutions. Like,
yeah,
she's the one that figures it out. And even Basil will occasionally get humbled to the point where he thanks her for her help. And
right. And, in the pilot here, she's the one who runs into the policeman and gets taken in on the investigation and tries to warn them, like, hey, that guy's a confidence trickster, right?
Yeah.
I love that. Not a con man. Confident. He's a confidence trickster. And she would have resolved it all if they'd just listened to her.
Yeah. No, totally. But they also, they have her in this like really important pivotal role, but they also have these really great side characters. They're very small ones. Like the colonel, like the ladies that live together that are always there. They're small and they're one note a lot of times. Like they're kind of, you know, the colonel's just kind of dopey and dippy and forgets things and always talks about car strikes. And that's him through the whole series. And he's always just a little off and very old and all of that. But I loved those characters, I think partially because the show doesn't, as much as they nail the kind of, I think, mundane structure, they still have quirky Britishisms all over the place. Like, it's still very, it's British-ass British comedy. And the things that the Brits find funny in the 70s.
What is it? A lemon squash and a scotch and water. I can't remember the first one. Is it a pink gin?
I don't remember. But that guy, he's like, yeah. A lemon squash and a scotch and water, please, by the end. Like,
there's such,
so
and there's three totally British drinks.
Oh, completely. Yeah. And that, but, and also just as a shout out.
Oh, by the way, everyone's pointing out it's the major, not the colonel.
Oh, I keep you saying colonel. I mean major, sorry. Yeah. Yeah. They always think of them as colonels because they're almost always colonels in every other stereotype.
Yeah.
But he's the major. He's great. And these, even the bit parts of the people that come in, there's an episode where the whole thing is about a lady who can't hear anything. She's got terrible hearing, and he has to keep telling her to turn up her hearing aid. That's such a mundane, like, boring premise. Like, oh, someone can't hear. You're going to be too quiet, and they can't hear you. They turn it up. You yell. It freaks them out. Ha, ha, ha. Like, these jokes you could write in junior high. But something happens on this show that elevates it to a whole new level. And I totally buy it, and I totally laugh, and I just have such a great time with it. I'm clearly just smothering more praise on a thing I've already smothered praise on.
Well, I think one of the things that it does that makes some of those mundane plots work is they focus all the foibles on Basil.
Yeah.
Basil is always wrong, always overreacting, always motivated by the wrong concern. Mm-hmm. He is the worst.
Yep.
And so it allows the stereotypes to breathe,
yeah.
Right? Even the closest thing is his wife. Like you said, she's a little bit overly picky, but next to Basil, she looks perfectly reasonable.
Yeah,
like, just
does.
Hang the painting, right? Like, and it, if Basil was kind of a modest, quiet man, mm-hmm. she might appear horrible, but next to him, she looks fine. Mm-hmm. Manuel, it could be a kind of very cringy stereotype, and in some ways it still is because of the time, but they never undermine Manuel for being from Spain. They undermine Basil mm-hmm. for trying to pretend like he knows Manuel's culture, right? Mm-hmm. They mm-hmm. redirect all of that stereotype stiping of a foreign worker onto Basil. Manuel's a little bit of a caricature. I, you know, he's not as straight as Polly, but he's always trying to do the right thing. And the only thing he ever runs into is like, I just don't understand what you're saying. And Basil's just very bad at saying it. And I love that moment where the person we find out later is the policeman just turns in imperfect Spanish, like, oh, what he's trying to tell you is this. And Manuel's like, oh, right. Okay. Well, that's, you know, and you get the fact that, like, oh, Manuel's not stupid. Basil's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that over and over and over throughout that series where they'll have the stereotype, but the stereotype isn't the butt of the joke. Basil is.
Right. Right. And in the case of Manuel, he's very sympathetic character.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not just a cartoon or a stereotype, or like you said, there's more there. You feel for him. You want to help him. There are times where I'm just like, oh dude, I'm so sorry. You have to even freaking deal with this. And then there are other times where he's just outlined funny. That guy just died, passed away last year. He's a German actor of all things. Hmm. He was wonderful in that role. It's just so good in it. In fact, a lot of people, I guess the only, well, if you go look up all the guest stars, most of the people who are involved in that series have since passed. But the main cast is still around. Like, I would love it if they would, with the exception of Manuel, I'd love it if they just got together and did like some kind of follow-up. Maybe they even have like some kind of just interview.
No, they've done plenty of interviews like on the DVDs and VHS and stuff, but they have said that, well, first of all, there's the rumor that there was a 13th episode that was shot, but was never released. It was never finished.
Yeah. What happened to that? What was the deal there?
It was never progressed further than a rough cut. Cleese talked about one time that he had an idea for a follow-up in the 90s that would have involved Basil being retired and visiting, Barcelona, somewhere in Spain. And, you know, Manuel being there and sort of flipping the script where we're now Basil was in Manuel's country. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it just never happened. And Cleese has said now, he's like, we're too old. And Connie, I think, has said the same thing. We would never be able to do it now. I don't think there's ever going to be a reunion. But they have done some talking about it. In fact, Connie Booth refused to talk about it for years. But she finally, in the last 4 or 5 years, decided to do allowed an interview about it. In celebration of the anniversary. So there's lots of material out there if you really want to get behind the scenes.
Sure.
But I just don't think they're ever going to they're going to do another one of these.
Probably not. And it, again, you said lightning in a bottle. It does feel like that. It feels like this special moment of perfect people, perfect timing. This was also Cleese getting toward the end of Python Central. And he was, by other interviews I've heard with him recently in a documentary, he was ready to spread some. He wanted to kind of, he needed a break. He needed to get away from this a little bit.
He's often blamed with the breakup of Monty Python. Yeah.
In fact, that last season of Flying Circus, he's barely in it.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people didn't like viewer wise. So he was right. I mean, there was a lot of pressure on him, but also everybody wanted him. So he was kind of, you couldn't have Monty Python without John Cleese, I think. I think that's just the way it was. I think you could say, I have a more mature view of Python now, but I think it's true of all of them. Like, I wouldn't want to see a big reunion after Graham Chapman passed away.
They did a bit of a reunion in the, it was the 2000, I think.
Was it the stage thing where they did
that stage and, you know, thing? And they made some funny allusions. They did some like sketch setups kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They were very careful not to try to look like they were redoing Python, but they did some fresh material and it was fairly funny. And then they did the reunion performances.
Right.
But yeah, I think without Graham Chapman, it's not the same.
It's not the same.
Absolutely not the same.
They can do little spinoffs, like, you know.
Yeah, I think without any of them, it's just not the same overall. Yeah. I mean, granted, there were funny sketches that didn't have Cleese in them. There were funny sketches that didn't have Chapman in them.
Yeah.
And those stand the test of time. But the ensemble really worked together.
Yeah.
Cleese in Fawlty Towers shows that he could do something that didn't require the ensemble and was funny. And I think that was one of the things he was dying to do at that time in his life.
Yeah. It didn't have to contain the absolute absurdity that a character he would do in a sketch would have, you know,
that's the thing, right? You can't do Python without everybody in Python, but you could do something else. That's what he did.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like, Terry Gilliam going off to become this huge director that he's become.
Director. Yeah. Yeah.
His La Mancha thing's finally coming out next year, which is super exciting.
Is it though?
That's what they say. I mean, this one has Kylo Ren in it, so it's a little more modern.
We'll see.
We'll see if it works out. But
I would almost be disappointed if it made it out. Like, it's just too much, too hilarious.
Now,
the story.
The thing that made my mom worry that this was something I shouldn't be watching when I was younger was the titles that they broadcast on PBS had these signs out front. It was the Fawlty Towers sign.
Mm-hmm.
And it would say, the first episode, this pilot says Fawlty Towers on it. By the way, the music's all jacked up in this pilot in the very beginning. Did you notice that? It's weird. I don't know if you noticed this. I'm going to play it so no one knows I'm crazy. But just for funsies, check this out. So here's episode one, the very beginning. It's only taking me 2 seconds. At least that's what I thought it would take. And here it is. Okay, so I'm just going to play this, and then we're going to go back. Oh, that's
today we have
wrong episode. Let's go back to episode one. Okay, Touch of Class is the one we're talking about. Here you go. Listen to this intro.
Right.
This intro is real weird. Okay, BBC logo. Okay, go back. Okay. Do you hear it twice?
I guess I do. Is that just
weird?
You, though?
No.
I don't remember that happening to me.
It's happening right now. It's the Netflix transfer, so I don't know why it's doing that. It drove me freaking nuts this time because I thought,
I watched it on Netflix, and I don't remember hearing that.
Yeah, it's first thing.
Maybe
that
I just didn't notice
me.
It, though.
But anyway, the point is, at the beginning, it would say, you know, Fawlty Towers on the sign. But then the next week, you'd tune in, and it would say, Farty Towels. Some kid had gone and messed with the letters. And
right, not the title of the episode, but each episode had the sign messed up.
Exactly. And every time they'd change it, it would be this thing to look for when the show would come on. It's like, oh, what they do this time?
It's like at Bob's Burgers. What's the sign going to be on the store next door? What's the van going to say when it
Exactly. Comes? Like, it was like this. Or how is Lisa going to play her saxophone?
Right.
How
is what Simpsons is Bart going to write on the chalkboard?
Exactly. And it seems like a very early version of that. I don't know. I don't know what we could point to and say, here's the first show that ever did that fun little obscure thing with titles. But to my original point, I always thought that was very funny. But also, my mom hated it because a couple of them, they're all anagrams of Fawlty Towers, and a couple of them were a little naughty. And I remember her seeing one of those and going, I don't know if this is a show you should be watching.
I mean, not really. They're not really naughty. Not I guess naughty. Naughty is a good word. Yeah. They're not offensive.
Not really. One of them was kind of bad. Chat room, you probably know which one I mean.
No, they have them all listed on the Wikipedia.
Oh, yeah. Do they? All right. Well, the point is...
But they were all still allowable for broadcast television in the 80s.
Oh, so. Totally. Totally. I mean, yeah. when I was watching Benny Hill on PBS, and, you know, that thing had boobs in it. So you kind of got... So did Faulty Earth. So did Monty Python as well. Flying Circus had all kinds of boobs in it. And that was just the way it was. And we all loved that, of course, as junior high kids. But
ours didn't.
Oh, do you guys have it edited out?
They always blurred that stuff at Channel 9.
Not here, man. We had Channel 7.
Utah is just much more progressive than St. Louis.
Yeah, contrary to every other stereotype ever said, we are way more progressive. No, I remember that was a thing, and maybe it was late at night or something, but that was always like, oh, we should go, you know, we're all in seventh grade. Never seen
the one you're saying that was bad was the flowery one, right?
Yeah, that one. And my mom saw that and got all offended.
Did your mom even know what that was? Like, I don't think any of us knew what that meant.
Well, she acted like she did, so I assume she did.
Maybe she did.
And it was kind of
much more progressive than someone.
It was a kind of a sweary term in high school or in junior high, I remember. So if you got caught saying that word, you'd get in trouble.
Maybe we did. I don't know.
But that whole thing was enough. That one episode, she happens to see the intro. And now I spend the next 2 weeks having this fight about, Mom, this is fine. Don't worry about it. Sit and watch a whole episode with me. My mom was just this way. She was crazy about this stuff. I mean,
My mom was very similar. I don't think she ever noticed these, and that's why I never, but I bet if she had seen Flowery and knew what it meant, she would have told me to turn it off.
It's still very, it's the most Python thing about the show, honestly, is those titles.
Yeah.
Like, it's really out there and funny and very funny anagrams. But the point is, the reason I was getting all of this, the screen titles, different than the sign, but the screen titles were never in the broadcast. These were all added in VHS. So have we ever seen it? We've never seen like the raw cut without that stuff. As far as I know, we haven't. I've never seen it.
Well, I did on the Netflix transfer. It didn't say A Touch of Class ever, did it?
No.
I don't think it came up.
Maybe these are those.
So I could. I don't know if that's the original cut or not.
I'm looking right here. Let's see. Faulty Towers. The S is slightly askew on the sign. It's not It's not too askew. Okay, then we got, we roll in with by John Cleese and Connie Booth. Still an exterior shot of the hotel. And then it says nothing. It fades. You're right.
Yeah, I think the point was not so much about it being on screen, which I think it was in the U.S., but they didn't have titles. It was like Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks didn't have titles either.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They added them later. Yeah.
No. Oh, why would they? Well, whatever. It's fine. If
episode one, episode two, episode three, right?
Yeah, that's what I guess that's what TV needs. But so part of me, speaking of that, part of me is stoked that the show only ran for 12 episodes because it came, it conquered, and it went. And I can miss it and wish there was more, but also it's didn't stay overstay its welcome, you know? Like they didn't go on
it
for 10 years.
It often gets credit for that, although I'm unconvinced that that was by design. I think it was just because they were having so much trouble, you know, getting Connie to cooperate and do more.
Yeah.
And Cleese too, maybe. He may have been like, yeah, okay, I'm done with this. I got to move to something else. But lots of people have pointed to that as reasons that they didn't do more series. Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant both said the reason we quit The Office UK when we did was because we knew Faulty Towers was so good because it never stayed on long enough to get bad, and we didn't want to do that either.
Mm-hmm. They were happy to produce the American one that went on too long. because
How much were they involved in that? That was an NBC decision, I'm sure.
Probably. Oh, they also had a lot more episodes per season. Like I said,
and they had an American producer really running that. Gervais and Merchant, I think, were just advisors.
Yeah, they got their money and they were good. But no, there's something to that. Like I kind of wish other shows would not overstay their welcome. Like I feel like Lost maybe overstayed its welcome a little bit. It was also Lost was at that weird pivotal point where network TV and cable were starting to look at 12 episode seasons instead of 24 and go, maybe there's something to this. And they were kind of caught in the middle of that and they had to do reruns and it was kind of this messy thing. And maybe they just went on a little too long. Whereas a show like Faulty Towers and a lot of British stuff, honestly, they come, they make them, and they go. And then everyone's good with it. We're like, yep, that's the show. It exists in perpetuity. It doesn't have to go on forever with new people, we don't have to have people age 10 years and try to pretend they're still in school or whatever. You get away with it in animation. You can do it with Family Guy and South Park and Simpsons and everybody, because you can create the illusion of time, and everybody, they're all adults playing these kids anyway. Bob's Burgers, another good example that just hit 10 years or is about to. That's kind of the domain for that. But I feel like live action stuff, maybe we ought to be more like Fawlty Towers, be short.
It all depends on the show, right? For example, Sidian points out in the chat, Doctor Who, with a gap, has been on for 50 years, right? They had a premise in there that said, hey, we can swap out the Doctor, yeah, and it's part of the plot. Mm-hmm. So we can keep this thing going forever. EastEnders is the soap opera in the UK that has been running forever. I don't even know how many years that thing's been running.
Wow.
But they just, you know, it's a soap opera. So they just, you know, people age out and they bring in new characters and boop doop doo. It just keeps on going. So there are exceptions to that rule. But I think what's interesting is there isn't a requirement of like, your goal is to be on forever. Mm. And as soon as you get canceled, you've failed.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the way it felt. I don't think it feels that way anymore in the US. I think Lost sort of, like you say, has sort of helped break that. Mm. For the longest time, though, is like every television show on should try to last forever.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, why MASH was on for 11 seasons.
I agree.
Because, hey, why, you know, even we don't care if the Korean War was only a couple of years. We're going to keep this show on as long as it'll get the ratings.
Well, not only.
And not every other country does that. Mm-hmm. In China, they put on shows. One season will have 60 episodes and they'll air two to four a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're done, they're done.
They're just
and that's
done.
It.
Yeah. Different sensibilities, different cultures.
Yeah.
I was going to add to that. What was I going to say? Oh, I forgot. Oh, I know. If a show, I think I'm more thinking of comedies is where the problem is. So it's not so much a problem with dramas. Like if you structure your drama in such a way, like say a Law and Order or something, that can go 20 years. You have new district attorneys,
right.
New cops.
Follow the, yeah, yeah.
It's the procedural, and the people on the periphery just have to serve the procedural, right? And I think that can be done pretty successfully. And lots of shows have proven that out. But comedies are hard, I think, to maintain the tempo, to maintain the quality of the comedy. Friends went too long, in my opinion. It's just not funny those last couple seasons. Mm. I wish it was. I watched it recently again with my wife, whole watch through. It bums me out toward the end. It may be a little bit of a binge thing as well to amplify it, but you really notice it. Seinfeld even had one of the greatest comedies ever. My second favorite comedy of all time, Seinfeld, has real problems in its final season. It's a couple of great episodes, but there's some issues. Like, just goes too long. This thing ends, and you're like, damn it, I want more of this. But something tells me, as I've gotten older, I've come to grips with this idea that that's okay. Like, that Fawlty Towers came, and it went right when it should have. And we have this pristine 12-episode amazing thing. And we should cherish it and restore it and keep it good and make sure there's lots of good future transfers of the thing to digital or however else we're going to carry it forward and preserve it because it's that good. But it's okay that it didn't run for 10 years. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, you always leave them wanting more, right? Like that's kind of the idea. I would feel better about it a little bit if Fawlty Towers had said our intention was always to just do 12 episodes. Mm-hmm. We only had 12 episodes in us we thought were worth doing. I do feel like, gosh, I bet they could have done 18 and mm-hmm. they would have been just as good. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be cool to have six more? So there is a part of me that's like missed opportunity because things just didn't fall where they may.
Yeah.
At the same time, I end up at the same place as you. I'm thankful that we have these 12 and that they're as good as they are.
And I don't need Sam Malone looking longfully at his bar from the door for 10 minutes. Like I don't need those sappy endings to a long running comedy. They annoy me. At least Seinfeld decided to go out on nothing but jokes. Like a lot of people don't like the Seinfeld finale. I would recommend people go watch that again outside of the hype bubble because I think it's kind of brilliant. And they go out kind of on their own terms and it's very strong. I really don't like sitcoms specifically where mm-hmm. the last episode is the sappy, sad freaking thing. And I get why we do it. I'm not saying
it's
not. Oh, I hate it.
I love it. I will hate a Friends season. I actually didn't hate it, but I'm with you. Like that last season is like, all right, what did my wife get me into? Because she's the one who got me to start watching Friends when we got together in 2000. I hadn't watched it through the 90s. I was like, you know, whatever. Not really. And then she got me into it and I caught up. And then that we're both like, well, I guess, you know, it's just time for it to go. Mm-hmm. But I loved the goodbye episode. It's sentimental. It's like, oh, end of an era. Mm-hmm. I want to say goodbye to these characters. I love the sappy endings.
I don't. Again, I appreciate why it works for so many, you included. Like, I think it's fine. And if you're going to do a show for that long, and if you allowed some of the sap in earlier, then that's fine, too, because you've already got a precedent. Like, you've got sap with Ross and Rachel. You have sap with relationships and discoveries and all this stuff. You got a little bit of on a very special episode of Blossom happening, right? That happens. but what I always admired about Seinfeld and what I really admire about Fawlty Towers even more is they were always, it's funny first, screw the sentimentality. Like, we're here to make you laugh. We're not here to have the audience go, oh, or go, woo, when you kiss. F that. That sucks. Like, I am so for this model of just make me laugh and move the F on. It's not like you can't do it and make it well. Like, I think there's plenty of, speaking of animation, Simpsons episodes that are extremely heartfelt and wonderful. The episode of Futurama with the dog, Fry's dog, I don't even want to spoil that one, even though it's old. People should go watch that episode. It'll bring tears to your eyes. It can happen, and it works in some parts of the medium. I just don't think it works in a half-hour sitcom very well. So that's why these guys are my heroes. I just love them. Come in, laugh, that's your craft, get out.
And that is why I will say, and will agree with you, that I'm very glad we didn't get a final episode of Fawlty Towers, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the idea, it's perfectly fine to have something just be like, and they kept doing that from then on, right? And in your imagination, you can imagine Basil slowly growing old, and that's it. That's what they do. So I'm fine with that. And I don't need every series to have the sappy ending. I don't need every series to wrap things up neatly unless they've promised that to me.
Sure.
Unless they've telegraphed, hey, this has an ending that we're moving towards, then I want to see that damn ending. But Fawlty Towers was never that show.
No.
It was never promising to solve a mystery or reveal something.
But Friends was always going to give you that ending. You know, that was going to be their job, and they did their job, and that's totally fine. Doesn't make me dislike Friends. There are parts of Friends I think are hilarious. Parts of Friends that make me want to pull my eyes out. Fawlty Towers never has a moment where I want to pull my
eyes out. Don't pull your eyes out, kids.
Yeah, it's you need your eyes, it turns out. Chat room says, what
then
about
you have to do these expensive surgeries like Scott did.
Yeah, nobody wants that. Somebody says something about the Newhart ending in the chat. Yes, the Newhart ending is a special case. I don't even know how they got away with it or got to approve it at all. Like, but what they did with that is amazing. And if you haven't seen it, you should owe it to yourself to see it.
You kind of, I don't know if it works anymore though, right?
It may not.
It worked at its time because people had knew both television shows.
Yeah, you'd have to go educate yourself and watch them again or something. Yeah. In fact, Hulu's got all the old ones and they're great. A very funny old sitcom.
And actually, the Lucas Light just made me laugh. Lucas Light wrote in the chat room, Game of Thrones, no ending? Fine, doesn't need one. George R. R. Martin. I don't think that's what George R. R. Martin thinks.
But no. It's going to be all spinoffs. I have this actual fear that there is no book six. It's just going to be spinoff content on HBO, and that's the best we're going to do. I'm a little worried about it. I mean, we'll see. I'll be okay. I'll be all right. My world doesn't end if George R. R. Martin decides to scrap the sixth book. But
I'll be very disappointed.
I'd be disappointed.
If he scraps it.
Yeah.
I'll be too. Very disappointed if he doesn't get a chance to write it, but my world won't end either.
No.
I get what you're saying.
You and I will perpetuate. We'll continue.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll keep moving.
I want to talk before we wrap up about the fact that Basil Fawlty is based on a real person.
Yeah. Someone they met, the pythons were out of town or something. What was the story?
They were shooting. I think they might've been shooting Holy Grail. I'm not certain about that. I'm sure I have that wrong, but the pythons were shooting in Devon and they stayed at the Glen Eagle Hotel in Torquay, Devon, owned by one Donald Sinclair, who Cleese just was fascinated with, because I'm sure he wasn't as exaggerated as Basil Fawlty, but he was the kind of person who just grumped about, didn't seem to want to run the hotel, blamed things on staff problems constantly. Yeah. And Cleese and Connie Booth ended up apparently staying on after the rest of the pythons left because they just wanted to research this hotel. And that's why Fawlty Towers is located in Torquay. because it's an it's I guess an homage would be a way to put it to the Glen Eagle Hotel.
Sure, I would love to. It'd be fun to I don't know if any archival anything exists, but it'd be fun to just see what that guy was like. And
I wish, yeah, I wish there was some kind of video of the real Donald Sinclair.
Yeah, because I can kind of picture.
I'm sure he wasn't as over the top.
Oh, sure.
As Faulty.
Sure,
but
I've been in a bed and breakfast once where I was surprised at how abrasive and unservice oriented the people that were running it were, things like that. Not nearly to this level, like you say. So I would be very curious, somebody who inspires John Cleese to build a character and then make a show based on that character with his writing partner and then wife must have been something else to watch that guy in real life. That must have been crazy. But who knows? One day we may know, because I don't know. I feel like John Cleese is to the point in his life where we're going to either get a bunch of interviews soon or not at all. And I hope we get a bunch of things. He's actually doing something. Someone in the chat says he's on some show now. What's it called? Hold on.
Well, there's tons of interviews with John Cleese out there. Well, it's not like he's been avoided.
But there's some show called Hold the Sunset. Have you heard of this? I don't know what this is. Hold the Sunset. Let me just quickly.
Hold the Sunset. It's John Cleese time.
Oh, there it is. It's a BBC One show. And it's rated poorly. Well, that's too bad. Anyway, John Cleese is in that, and it's a bunch of old people. Oh, I see. Edith and Phil are two neighbors who are keen to start a relationship and a new life abroad. These plans are disrupted when Edith's immature 50-something son, Roger, moves back home after leaving his wife and children. So, John Cleese.
Hilarious.
John Cleese and Rosie Calavario play the parents. And then I can't tell who plays who. But anyway, okay, well, whatever. It sounds like a hoot and a holler. There. Maybe it's okay.
Also, another little factoid to throw out there, if people didn't realize, he was so taken with Donald Sinclair that Cleese wrote a hotel owner into the series Doctor in the House. Cleese was a writer on that series. And so there's an episode of May 30th, 1971 of Doctor in the House with a sort of grumpy hotel owner played by Timothy Bateson that Cleese says was basically the prototype of Basil Fawlty. He tried out the idea in that episode.
Yeah. Also, I think I found out why people, there's an inordinate number of negative reviews for the new thing. Apparently it's very anti-Brexit, and that's controversial. So,
Well, you can't trust any review anymore.
No.
Because people manipulate them one way or another based on what they think everyone else should think.
We should solve that problem.
Everyone should think exactly alike.
You and I should solve that problem. Scott and Tom fix reviews somehow. And we end up changing the world with the way we figured out a whole new way to do reviews. And they become the most trusted voices in the world on everything from appliances to film to everything. How can this be done? How can we accomplish it? And make
I think
our
the
millions?
Wire Cutter already did it for appliances.
Ah, damn it. You're right, they did. Wire Cutter really.
The Wire Cutter method was applied to movies.
They could.
We're going to watch this movie for 3 months.
Yeah.
We're going to watch movies like it.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to tell you what the best space movie is.
They could do that, and they could do it in a way that was as scientific as possible, meaning, you know, not just about what you usually like or your favorite genres or whatever. It would be, this has this much time devoted to this kind of action, therefore it fits within this range, you know, and so we're watching these other movies. They're like, that's an interesting idea. Who owns
that's
them?
That's a
now?
Lot of work.
Who bought them? Somebody big bought them recently. Throw some money at
ooh,
that.
Wirecutter? I think New York Times.
New York Times bought them. Throw some some of that hot new subscriber money at Wirecutter.
Mm-hmm.
Let's make it more than Bluetooth speakers and freaking ironing boards. Okay? Get on that. All right, that's it for the show. I love Fawlty Towers. If you guys have not seen it, it's in its entirety on Netflix and worth every second and repeat viewings. And it's also very short. Like we said, episodes
yeah, that's
are
the
like
thing.
20
this
minutes.
This is one where I was thinking like, maybe I should just watch them all again, which I know you do regularly. But because it's only 11 more episodes for me to watch, it's totally doable. And they're only half hour.
Yeah, they're short. They're quick. They're very bite-sized. They're great for just in the background.
The
if you've already seen them.
Quality per second of content you get is amazing.
It's a very high quality per second content. It's way above USDA approved levels of that stuff. Before we
and
go,
Kroger has a sale.
Before we get out of here and tell you what our next month's thing's going to be, let's do a quick email from Thomas from Missouri. He's talking about our last episode where we, well, not our very last episode, two episodes ago, where we covered One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's got a nice little nod in the Oscars during the In Memoriam
stuff. I wondered if you'd noticed that too. Yeah.
I saw that and I turned around. Everybody said, hey, Tom and I just watched that movie. I forgot Milos Forman died last year.
Passed away last year. Yeah.
Totally forgot about that. Anyway, I was listening to Current Geek 202, the one about the one who flew over the cuckoo's nest, and I was thinking about mental health and the institutions dedicated to it when I remembered an episode of Tell It Anyway. This is our good friend Jenny Josephson's show. On that particular episode, Matt Flanagan, her husband, talked about this time in an institution, or his time in an institution, and it is exactly... Sorry, I can't read today. It is an excellent, well-told story. I found it moving and touching, but it's also an episode of Tell It Anyway, so it's also very funny. And he gives a link to it. It's actually the episode called Of Men in White Coats. So if you're looking for it, track down that podcast and listen to that episode.
I listened to that episode. It is an excellent episode. Yeah. I highly recommend
it's
it
great,
as well.
It's a great show in general. What a great show. Anyway, also wanted to say how much I am enjoying these film episodes of Current Geek. Quite a few of these films I haven't seen before, so it's been very enlightening to watch some of these classic films. Thanks for the show, Thomas from Missouri.
Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you, Thomas. That's awesome. We're glad to hear that.
Thank you for showing me the email.
See?
Show me state.
See? Yeah. That's pretty good. May your golden arch ever... I don't know. What else do they do there? They got other things.
Golden arch?
No, that's St. Louis. What am I thinking of?
Oh, that's not golden. That's McDonald's. Oh, the St. Louis has the arch. Yeah.
It's just the St. Louis arch.
Yeah, it's silver.
It's not the... Okay, so it's not the golden
arch.
There
used to be a riverboat McDonald's moored right below the arch on the Mississippi River.
Well, of course you'd know that. Of course Tom would know that.
That's not there anymore.
That is some Tom-ass trivia right there. all right, next month's autopilot will be Ashes of Love. Never heard of it.
I just made this decision because we forgot to talk about this before the show. Yeah. And I've been wanting you to watch this. It is a Chinese drama. It is on Netflix. You don't have to get any weird special things to watch it. It is subtitled though. But I think it will intrigue you because it is a genre called wuxia, which has to do with martial arts, but it's a subgenre of that, which I won't try to pronounce because I think it's zansha or something, that is like fantasy martial arts.
Okay.
So it all takes place with gods in heaven. And when I watched this for the first time, my initial reaction was, wow, that looks like it's inspired by WoW. And that looks like it's inspired by WoW and Warcraft. And oh my gosh. And so if for no other reason, I just want your opinion on how much of this strikes you that same way.
Okay. No, that sounds like it's up our alley. Totally. I'll watch that. That sounds great.
Yeah.
That's next month. We'll cover Ashes of Love. Next week, we will have a regular newsy sort of discussion episode of the show. So come on back for that. We know you guys enjoy those as well. And stick around to the end of the show because Legal Geek is back with some interesting stuff about celebrity parents. He gives a review of that and a review of some inventors we know from other fields who came up with inventions well outside of what they're famous for.
Celebrity patents.
What'd I say? Parents?
Parents.
I did. Can't read
you
nothing
can't
today.
Patent your parents.
My ability to read has been slightly goofed up. Yes, Legal Geek will tell you all of that and more.
You need that surgery on your eyeballs. Like
that's so true. Tom Merritt, before we go, is there any other thing you'd like to mention?
Yes, I'm going to be in Austin, Tejas for South by So Wasted, the Night Attack celebration with Brian Brushwood and Justin Robert Young. You can go to bit.ly/nightattackaustin to get all the details. If you're headed into Austin or you think you would like to head into Austin, go now, get a ticket. It's going to be an actual, like, legit event with bands and the Ice Cream Social podcast and the Night Attack podcast, and I'll be involved in the Night Attack podcast, and it's going to be a blast. So if you can all at all make it, whether you're in the area or you can get there, again, go get those tickets because there's only 150 tickets before they start ripping out the seats. You need to get those tickets. bit.ly/nightattackaustin.
Great idea. And if you're hearing this and saying, I would also like to go to that TMS meetup in April. Hey, that's happening too. And I'll bet you Tom Merritt will be at that as well.
Oh, I'll be there too.
That's going to be a fantastic little event. We have an esports event on that Thursday, final weekend of that month, where we're going to be playing Overwatch with a bunch of people in an esports arena at the Luxor. It's going to be rad. Nice. Doing some play-by-play myself, but also I'll be on a team for the games that I end up playing. But no one has to even be good. There's medals, but you don't have to be good. You can just
be
there
I'll
for
be
fun.
There, and I'm horrible.
Tom's horrible, and he'll play. He'll just sit down and play. Tickets still available for this
I'll
as well.
I'll lay down and get shot. Sure.
Also, plenty of other fun shenanigans planned for that weekend in Las Vegas. Details at vivatmsvegas.com if you're looking into that. All right, that's going to do it for us. Currentgeek.com is our website. You will find everything there, including a link to our Patreon at patreon.com/currentgeek. It's how we keep the lights on. Thank you for your support. That's going to do it for us. For me, for Tom, we'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, while many are preening over the outfits and the awards given to celebrities at the Oscars, we take a look at some patents granted to celebrities which may surprise you. Who knew some of these people were also inventors? Good ideas can really come from anyone, and celebrities are no different. Let's take a look at a few granted U.S. patents, and their well-known inventors famous for something entirely different. Back in the 1980s, when Jamie Lee Curtis was working on Halloween movies, among other hits, she was also having children. One time when changing a diaper on her daughter, she discovered that she left the wipes across the room, which made for a tough conundrum of leave the messy diaper open to go get the wipes, or try to deal with the mess without wipes. So she invented and patented the Dipe and Wipe, a diaper with a pouch to hold wipes on site at all times. This patent granted in 1988, but it was never heavily marketed. It is in the public domain now for all to use, if wanted. Neil Young is better known for his music as a two-time Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, but his passion on the side is model trains. He has a barn filled with model trains on his property. He actually held an ownership stake in the model train company Lionel for a while in the 1990s, and he developed and patented several things for the company during that time. One patent covers a controller that sends signals to model train locomotives using an electromagnetic field rather than requiring actual contact with the metal track materials, and this was developed to help his son with cerebral palsy control and enjoy the trains. He also patented a model train horn system that better allowed an operator to simulate many of the locomotive noises a real train makes. Before Bill Nye became the science guy on children's TV, he was a mechanical engineer who worked at Boeing. Just because he stopped being a full-time engineer doesn't mean he stopped inventing, and it's no surprise many of his inventions stem from the shows he produced. But one particular patent on ballet toe shoes stands out as way outside Bill Nye's normal field. When he interviewed Seattle ballet dancers who were appearing on an episode about bones and muscles, he realized the toe shoes ballet dancers used to dance on point could be improved to help avoid many of the injuries young women were experiencing from this dance form. His patented shoe from 2005 adds a tubular support sleeve and a particular polymer material for additional shock absorption. The bottom line is, the patent field is full of inventors from all walks of life, including these celebrities who we consider to have extraordinary skill in another art. Inspiration can come from everyday problems, and those same problems being solved is precisely the type of evidence that patent offices in the US and other countries find persuasive when deciding whether to grant patents. While many people look forward to the next fashion statement on the red carpet from celebs, I look forward to being surprised by new inventions that these same people can come up with. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.